Good morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ, at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show today.
This story was first published on November 3rd of 2013 under the headline, "Was Suspicious Death in the Boneyard Really a Murder?" Here we go. This is the story of Portland's coldest cold case file. A suspicious death in the worst neighborhood of the old Stumptown waterfront, almost lost in the mists of time 135 years ago. Was it an accident? Or a murder? We'll never know for sure, but there are good reasons to be suspicious. This story was first published on November 3rd, 2013, under the headline, "Was Suspicious Death in the Boneyard Really a Murder?" Our story begins in a smoky, lamp-lit saloon in the rough part of Portland back in early February of 1878. W.H. Harrigan, one of the tough, hard-working longshoremen who worked the docks in early Portland, was having a drink or two with his friend Thomas McMahon, known to enemies and friends alike as Mac. Mac was a scow operator on the river in charge of one of the big flat-bottom boats that helped shuttle cargo among ships in the harbor. He lived in a cabin on board the scow. Mac wasn't his usual free-spirited self that evening. In fact, Mac told Harrigan he was flat-out scared. He explained he'd gotten in a fight with a man named Jack Aberhagen a week or two before, and Aberhagen had beaten him badly and then pulled a knife. Aberhagen was at that moment under arrest in the city jail awaiting trial for this deadly assault. But McMahon was worried that Aberhagen would come for him and finish the job so that he couldn't testify against him. And would Harrigan be willing to come spend the night at his place for protection? Harrigan said he would. But as the night went on, the two of them proceeded to, as it were, tax their capacity for intoxicating liquors. They did such a fine job of this that Harrigan was arrested for public drunkenness and thrown into the drunk tank. And that was the last time Harrigan would ever see McMahon alive. The next day, Harrigan stopped by McMahon's scow to check on him and found no sign of the man anywhere. Alarmed, Harrigan kicked in the door of the scow. There was no sign of Harrigan, but all his belongings were still there in the scow, including, most alarmingly, $4.50 in cash. That's about $105 worth in today's money. Quote, "I then started for uptown," Harrigan said during the coroner's inquest that followed a few weeks later. "And after I had passed the house of Boneyard Mary, she called to me and said McMahon had fallen in the river, that she saw him swimming, and that she thought he had gotten out as someone struck a light in the scow." Boneyard Mary was the nickname of a woman named Eliza Bunnets, who lived on one of the old river boats in the steamboat company Boneyard, the place where old steamboats were moored after they were mostly worn out in case parts were ever needed. Aesthetically, the boneyard was kind of like a combination of a junkyard and a haunted mansion, the whole thing floating on an occasionally evil-smelling river at the foot of Flanders Street, decrepit by day and, in those pre-streetlight days, positively sinister by night. McMahon's scow was anchored right next to the boneyard, so he and Boneyard Mary were neighbors. But, it seems, not friends. Boneyard Mary gave her occupation as laundress, and, well, maybe she was. A careful reading of the newspaper accounts, though, does suggest that she perhaps derived most of her income in other ways. Well, Harrigan had no reason to disbelieve Boneyard Mary. He moved on, trying to convince himself that McMahon had simply gone on the lam to avoid being called as a witness against Aberhagen. But something about the whole thing bothered him, especially that money. Why would he leave his money behind? 2 weeks later, Harrigan's worst fears were realized. A young boy fishing off a nearby dock hooked and reeled in the unfortunate McMahon's corpse. At the coroner's inquest, Harrigan told his story, and then it was Boneyard Mary's turn. She said the evening Harrigan was arrested, she was there when he arrived home for the night. Quote, "I went inside the house and told neighbor Mr. Nelson and his wife that McMahon was very drunk," she testified. I then stepped out on the wharf and in a few minutes heard a splash in the water. I ran to the edge of the wharf and looked down in the river and saw an object in the water that I thought was him. Boneyard Mary then went back into the house and notified Nelson and his wife that McMahon had fallen in the drink. Nelson promptly came out to help. Quote,
Mr. Nelson went immediately on board the scow,
Punnett said,
and found a hat saturated with water, and Mr. Nelson said he thought he had gone in the cabin and was all right.
A few other interesting things developed out of Bunnett's testimony, though. First, Jack Aberhagen, the man arrested for beating and knifing McMahon, was, as it turned out, more than just Bunnett's friend. He'd been living with her for several weeks before the fight broke out. She'd been smuggling letters to him in jail, slipped inside newspapers, and the two of them were engaged to be married. Furthermore, she told the court, quote,
I think the fight between Aberhagen and McMahon was about some bad words being said by McMahon about me.
Also, after McMahon disappeared, Bunnett smuggled a letter to Aberhagen, quote,
stating that he need not be afraid now, as Mac had gone away.
That quote being by the newspaper reporter assigned to cover the trial. Could it be that Eliza Boneyard Mary Bunnett's had something to do with McMahon's drowning that night? Certainly, Bunnett's had the motivation to do the job. She was 40 years old, an age at which a working girl in the 1870s could not look forward to many more years of plying the trade. She'd met a man who wanted to marry her, to make her a, quote, respectable married woman again. Now that whole dream was being threatened by the prospect of attempted murder charges. If Aberhagen got hauled off to the state penitentiary, it was likely those wedding bells would go forever unrung. The only way that could be prevented with absolute certainty would be for McMahon to disappear before he could testify. And it's not hard to spin a not-too-fanciful theory about how she might accomplish such a thing. Here's a hypothetical scenario in which that might be done. Let's say, theoretically, that she sees Mac coming home drunk that night and sees her chance. She slips over to his scow with a bottle and a smile and maybe a little extra something to put in his drink. Or maybe she just drinks with him and goads him into having more than he should and he passes out. It would be the work of a few minutes to slip the unconscious McMahon into the river to quietly drown. Then she dips his hat in the water and plants it on the boat and trots up the wharf to the Nelson house to fabricate an alibi. Quote,
Mac is very drunk tonight,
she remarks, as if just making chit-chat, and then wanders back out again. She dawdles outside for 2 or 3 minutes and then hustles back in.
Help! She shrieks. Mac fell in the water! Help me get him out!
Nelson runs down to the scow and, as Boneyard Mary has planned, in our hypothetical scenario, finds the wet hat.
Oh, good, Boneyard Mary remarks innocently. He must have gotten out.
The two of them talk it over and decide McMahon must have run off to Washington Territory to avoid testifying against Aberhagen, and they all go to bed. Boneyard Mary has her witnesses and her alibi. The currents of the river seem likely to carry the body out to sea, and no one will be the wiser. Everything is going right according to plan until that pesky meddling kid fishes up McMahon's corpse and gets the cops involved. Could this be what happened that night? Maybe. Certainly would explain why there was a wet hat on the scow, even though McMahon never made it back aboard. But we'll never really know, because the coroner ruled the death an accident, and that was the end of that. The key source in this story was back issues of the Portland Morning Oregonian from February of 1878. That's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. And by the way, if you haven't yet, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're a lot like these columns, only expanded and updated to take advantage of a less restrictive format. We've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, Bad Ideas and Horrible People of Old Oregon, and more. Eventually the plan is for 8 of them, although how many are out right now depends on when you hear this. They're a lot of fun and would look great on your bookshelf. Hint, hint. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and learn more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m. So, yeah, it'll be a couple days before you get your next fix, but I don't have to tell you that Monday morning will be here in the blink of an eye, do I?
So yeah, that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studio. And now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.